Hey there, Shop of Phoenix. You are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer. Hey, Chris, how are you?
That's right. Here we are. Thanks, Dave. We have a guest lined up next week, I think. We're going to get the guest train back rolling. And please write in if you have somebody you'd like to hear from. You know, we're probably going to go with some classics and whatever else we find interesting.
Yeah.
This week, there's a number of things to talk about. One of the things that I'm glad and surprised to see so much writing about was the ATTR, the attribute function in CSS. Chrome has dropped a version of it, which is pretty cool. It's not new. We've been able to have that function for a long time, but it was really, really limited. I wouldn't be surprised if people either didn't know it or only used it a very handful of times when they are doing something like with text. So for example, it was like you can only get a string. So let me just get that out of the way first. When you use the ATTR function, what CSS thought you were getting was a string, regardless of what you think it was. If you put like data Dave equals 5 in your HTML and then in CSS said, you know, give me the attribute value of data Dave, it would give you 5 as a string. It would absolutely be unusable as the number 5. And there was no way to coerce it, really. I don't even remember any really exotic tricks or anything. I'm pretty sure there was just no way to get a 5 out of that.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, something like column count, you might be able to use a number, but most of the time you want that to be a string, like a pix value. So you couldn't concatenate either, right? You're just stuck, right?
I don't even think you could, you know, I know what you mean. Like something like line height is like unitless or whatever. Mm-hmm. So if you put like data line height 3 and then tried to use that value, I still think it didn't work. So it was really, really limited.
Yeah, just to like appending text to something, sort of.
Yeah,
like,
and then what do you use text for? Very, very little in CSS. The only thing is the content property, which you could put on pseudo elements. So if there's before and after, you'd go content, and then you'd use attribute and say what attribute you want. And that was useful once in a blue moon, and a lot of times for just like stuff you see on CodePen, for example, like doubling the text because you have some neat effect you want to do, and that was just an efficient way to do it or something. Or or you kind of like incorrectly used it for like a tooltip styling kind of thing. And I say incorrectly because that's not a particularly accessible way to do that. Important text in CSS. So it was really, really limited. And all of a sudden it went from really, really limited to really, really amazing. And the whole way for it to do that was basically just types.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like now if you put data column 5, you can say, oh, when I pull that off of there, I'm pulling it as an integer, essentially. And now I can use it in that way. Doesn't that seem so small? It's like the smallest little eep. And it just unlocks amazing properties. And one of the reason I say that is because think of how successful the concept of props is in, you know, JavaScript componentry and web components land.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you just feel so powerful when you're crafting a component. You're thinking, what is this component? What kind of data should this thing accept? And nobody has any trouble thinking of ideas for that. They're like, oh, well, you know, we'll take the number of columns, or we'll take a really generic size attribute that, you know, takes 3 different enums for how big it should be or whatever. People are prop happy, baby.
Yeah.
And this little tweak, it's kind of like unlocking the idea of props for all of HTML. And to me, that's just amazing.
Well, we're in web component land, and we do, you know, a lot of like, okay, I want to set the size to small or something like that, you know, and that small equals, I think I maybe said this in the last show, like 10 pixels or something. It kind of unlocks this thing where I don't have to do, like, I don't have to build this bridge between you specified this attribute and now I get to convert that attribute into some kind of value, and then I send that over to CSS, and then I write 20 CSS rules to like handle small, medium, large, extra large, or whatever. Like I can just say 2, you know, like size is 10 or whatever. And, you know, that's going to create problems and stuff like that. I'm sure like, you know, there's, but I don't have to build that bridge, you know, and, you know, you'd have to maybe validate, or you could in theory validate, but that's a lot easier than like building this sort of interpolation language. And I'm going to have less CSS because I can just specify a value, you know, I could even do my X small and then just say whatever, real size, add the property real size is 10. And then in my CSS, I say add a real size or whatever. Like I could trick it, I guess is what I'm saying. Like I could still shim it, but I don't have to write as much CSS to build these different like size variants or what would be another like example. I mean, any kind of ramp really, like padding ramps, and you know, like you can just kind of do that in, you know.
Yeah. I like your example of using kind of like enum like values too, because I think that's a nice way to think about it. You know, I know that kind of Tailwind kind of faced the same problem. They're like, isn't this just inline styles? You know, that was like a pushback kind of thing, which I don't think is, I think is like, it's not, I get that it's not valid criticism and that you can define different gradiated values and use them, and no, it's not the same as inline styles, and there's pushback, but at the same time it's like, but listen to the feedback here, you know. But this likewise, this is not inline styles, and it's valuable that it isn't inline styles because it gives you this second layer of interpolation, which is the language of CSS to do something with it. I guess we mentioned this last time because now I'm remembering me talking about how it's also this kind of opportunity to bail on what you're doing. Like if you said, you know, data color is red or something, that doesn't force you to make it red for the rest of your life. CSS has a say in that, you know?
Yeah. But you know, I do think like this, adding this sort of like shim layer, you know, like an enum basically, you know, and you're like, basically you set this value. Cool. This is, I'm going to set another thing to this. And then my CSS is only does that, you know, I'm already thinking of like grid areas, gaps, you know, padding stuff. I even started like daydreaming about like font size. You know how you have your type ramp, and I was in a big type ramp conversation yesterday. And you know how it's all like, you know, small, medium, caption two, extra large, title, display five, you know, like there's all these like words you're trying to use for like small, medium, bigger, little, you know? And I just was like, what if instead it's just base font size, which is 16 pixels, and then you say size minus two or something like that, you know? Like you just make it a calc function for the size, because I mean everyone's gonna be like, oh, actually I need it to be 13 pixels because that tested better or whatever. And so like I just was like, oh man, like what if we don't what if you just tell me what size it is, you know? Like I don't, what if I don't care in the CSS and you just send that down, and if you broke the design system rules, good job. Or I don't know, maybe I'll console warn you or something, like that's an inappropriate size or something. I was just like this is like a maybe this solves a whole bunch of problems with these sort of ramp values is kind of where I was going. So and then I don't know,
isn't there another thing too, is that you don't have to just set one thing. I keep saying stuff like data columns or data color, but it doesn't have to be. It could be just like data font largeness or something, whereas largeness isn't a real word, it's an invented word. And then it's doing multiple things, like maybe it's increasing the font size and reducing the line height and increasing the optical sizing of it, you know, like because we're working with the language of CSS, that we have all these opportunities to do multiple things.
Yeah, we're not limited. We can basically, we take an attribute and then we do stuff with it, you know? I mean, you could also dynamic set the size and then, yeah, trim the optical size, build some sort of math function that kind of, you know, determines the optimal optical size, you know?
Right.
You remember like modular scale? Who was that? Scott Kellum and a bunch of people. I have Scott Kellum on that one, but I'm sure there's, I think, other people involved. But like, you could be like scale three. It's like the third note on the scale and it's this big, you know, like, and you have that ramp figured out. Like, that's cool, huh? Like, this could be kind of cool. Like, I don't know. You get some golden ratio stuff and for free now, but I don't know. I just think it's kind of like, it's going to be cool. And I don't know. I put a link in the show notes. Did you see the Web Awesomes page component? It's in there. It's like in the secret backers link, but for some reason people post the links.
I backed it.
So you backed it?
I gave him hard-earned money.
You gave him $750,000.
Oh my God. Nope.
That's a good amount of money. So Web Awesome, I think in my like blog post on what web components shine, I was like, for page layouts, meh, not so much, you know, not you yeah, could.
And they just proved you the heck wrong.
Oh, totally. I mean, they're just like challenge accepted. And so anyway, they have this like page layout and basically they're using slots and sort of, it's sort of the similar idea. It's just saying like, I want this to generally go here, but they kind of build this whole page, like super layout and Uber layout in German for like, you know, basically it has everything. And then like based on the slots that you put in or these attributes, you know, that you chuck in there, then it kind of like builds the page and restructures and recodes it. And so it's really impressive tech. I mean, I think like, you know, I think like people have tried these like God layouts before in the past and it's sort of like, you know, loses a bit of spirit, I'd say, you know, but I think also people don't want to think about their layout so much, you know, like, is it 252 pixels or 256 pixels wide? You know, like they don't care. They just want.
Well, I think it's a stopping moment, you know, like this is like a bigger thought, but I was thinking of like, you know, I've written like nothing but Go for 2 weeks, it feels like. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like my skills are really increasing here, but are they really? Like, I don't know. Like if I was applying for a job or something, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm a big Go guy. Huge, huge Go guy.
Because
I
can't,
I don't know that I could, I don't know that I could start a new super effective Go code base. I mean, maybe I could, but I think I'm effective right now because there's so much stuff already in place that for me writing 2 weeks ago within our already nicely well-defined system, I'm all over it, right? Whereas I think some people feel that way about CSS. Like, I'm not bad at CSS, but I give me a blank page with none CSS.
Yeah,
I like that. I think that's fun to start from that. But I could see people not being feeling effective in that way. And layout is one of the things that could be the big stopper. And if it's like, you know, please just handle layout for me via this component that you're talking about, I could see it being big, you know.
Well, and for me, I'm always like, start with something and see what the system spits out, you know, like just start chucking stuff into the page machine and see what comes out. You know, I think like it's kind of cool. I don't know. It's interesting and it kind of gets, you know, they're using attributes and stuff like that. Like they're setting like breakpoints and stuff like that. And so I don't know if you could do like adder mobile breakpoint or something like that, but that would be kind of cool, right? Or like, you know, like what if we could, you know, like using this blend of like HTML and CSS to sort of like, so you have to write less CSS is kind of the deal. You know, I think that's the whole promise of Tailwind. I'm just describing Tailwind over and over. But I think it is this sort of neat idea where you can maybe use less to get more. So I don't know.
Certainly my parting thought on attribute, I know we barred a little bit, but is that, you know, I just want to reiterate one more time, just think in terms of props, you know, like think, does this thing that I'm passing as a prop to this component, could it just be an HTML attribute now? Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be for everything because there is no type of like object or JSON data or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not everything. But it certainly unlocks some big doors. And it's a big deal. I'm glad. You know, there's a great Una Kravitz has a good article on it. There's stuff we'll link up that's worth reading for sure. I have a Balatro. Is that how you say it? Question?
Balatro, yes.
Balatro, yeah. Welcome to the started to get into a little
Balatro
bit
because podcast.
Our friggin' Discord is obsessed. You know, I think the world is obsessed to some degree, but certainly it's popping off in our Discord in a big way. Do you just like play until you lose and then you just have to start over again? Is that, do I have that right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
okay. I just wanted to make sure because something felt like you're like building up something, like that it's like a longer term thing than that. But I was like, oh, I'm doing great. Oh, I lost. Oh, I'd really have to just start at the like $4 small blind again or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like poker. So like you're just playing poker, like 7-card draw. And you have to build a poker hand from your hand, and you can discard up and then they'll replace cards, and then you play your best hand, and then you get points based on how cool that hand is, right? And then
yeah, I get that part. Yeah, that's the basics. Really fun.
That's a game. But then there's this other game on top of it, which is like a deck builder. So you're basically like trying to buy cool jokers, and you have to unlock them over time. Like you know.
So that does it. Once you have unlocked it, does it stay unlocked forever in your Bellatro?
It's unlocked, but it's randomly distributed. So you'll get like two jokers to choose from usually, like when you start a new hand.
One's like $4 and one's like $6 and or something. Right?
Yeah. And so like in theory, the more uncommon or rare ones are more powerful, you know, but they're also a little quirkier, you know?
Right.
So when you get this thing, you kind of have to, you're shopping. You have to be like, okay, what would benefit me here the most, you know, if I play this and, you know, and so like, oh, I get this like one that gives me money, more extra money after every round. And then I found this other one that gives me points or extra chips based on how many dollars I have. Oh, those
you want them to work
synergy,
together, right?
Yeah. So you start.
Yeah. Like, really dumb synergies. Like, oh, like, I don't know. You get an extra multiplier for all the hearts you play. And then one of them is like, well, you get extra money for discarding clubs. It's like a little bit of synergy because, of course, you're trying to get hearts and not clubs. So they like work together a little bit, but they're not. Yeah. It's not like amazing or anything, but apparently there's some just amazing combos, right? I'm not sure I've ever hit like an amazing combo. Like how often do when you pick up blood and play that you're in your bank, you have $1,000?
No, never. I mean, like I've hit like 200 before, you know what I mean? Like,
Okay. As I was like, am I way behind? I'm like, am I just like embarrassing? Cause maybe I'll hit like 30, 25 bucks, 30 bucks, and then be like, yeah, well, I'm crushing it, baby. And then I lose and I'm like, well,
no, that's, I mean, like there is this like, Blatro tips. But if you get over $25, you get the max interest per round, which is $5. So like you get like $5 for beating the hand and then you get an extra $5. So now you have $10.
And that interest is just baked into the game, huh?
That interest is baked into the game. But then some like little, they're called vouchers, but like, or that, and some jokers as well that will, if you have that, then the interest cap goes away or doubles or something. So like you can now get $10 per round. So if you have $50, you get $10 per round. And then, you know, if you're buying out the shop, it's maybe $20 to clear out the whole shop, you know? And so you're always kind of like,
I was wondering about that. Like, as you keep going, is there like a joker that's $100? Not really.
I don't think so. Not that I've encountered, but possibly. I mean, shoot, okay. I don't know. There's a lot more left in the game.
I was like, maybe it's just showing me cheap jokers because I'm just early on in the thing.
Josh Collinsworth just 100%ed it. He finished, beat the whole
thing. Which means he got every joker.
Every joker, every card, every sticker, every challenge, every deck. And the decks have different stakes, like, you know, chip modifiers. Yeah, and
that eludes me. This, like, why would I want to modify my deck? Like, I kind of get it. It's like, what if I really like the ones that, I don't know, force me to always have hearts or whatever, like I said. Is it in my benefit then to build a deck which has more hearts in it? Can I do that?
Yeah. I mean, you can. There are like, you know, there's these arcana things.
But then it only matters if I randomly get that joker.
For sure. Like if you randomly get that joker and then you randomly get this like modifier that's like turn all these cards into hearts, which exists, you know, like.
Okay.
Now you're cooking with grease. However,
right,
the chances of getting both of them are very slim. So like, I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, and sometimes I do have a combo. Like it's like you get straights, you know, it's all awesome. And, you know, like I'm like, oh yeah, doing straights. Boom, boom, boom. I'm cooking. And then like one of the bosses, because the game has bosses too. Like every round gets more, you have to clear a higher bar. And then every third round, there's like a random challenge basically in there. Mm. every boss blind, you, but there's one that is like, you can't play your most powerful hand. Like the hand you've been playing this whole game, you can't play that anymore. So if you engineered this whole entire deck for straights or whatever, or all your whole thing is built for that, and then you're going to get hit with this, like, you can't play a straight. And then you're like, oh no, because everything's like,
that's awful.
Super weak. Anyway, yeah.
Can you control like what jokers are in a deck too? Or no, is that like not, jokers are not in the deck. They come randomly.
No, they come random. Okay. And then you can like buy little card packs and add certain cards to the deck. So you're not limited to four aces. You could buy a card deck and then, or buy a card pack and there might be an ace in there that you can add to your thing. So it's kind of up to you. Like, what,
so complicated. That's
what's kind of beautiful about it. I don't know. It's this simple game of like, we're playing poker. Right. And then there's this other game on top of it is like, and you're also collecting power-ups. And then there's this, you know, and then it's like, oh yeah, it's poker. But then there's like random challenges. Like you know, like you play with one less card or whatever.
It seems like you can, it is possible to extract enjoyment out of the game without necessarily engaging with its deepest nerderies.
Totally. From a, I have it on an iPad and it's just my solitaire game. You know how like your dad or mom or dad would always just play solitaire, click, 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 click. You know, it's like that for me, you know, it's like, I'm just playing solitaire. So,
well, that's got me thinking of, so Ruby, my 7-year-old daughter, loves Pokemon all of a sudden. And she started just randomly, just, I don't know, just not, we weren't consuming any particular media that had it. I think she's like, has a friend who had the plush doll or something. And she likes
what, second grade?
First grade.
Okay. Yeah.
Very, yeah. And just likes how the little Pokemon, they only say their name, you know? Right. So that's appealing to her to just walk around saying, or Jigglypuff sings and they go to sleep and stuff. All right. So, but I was like, well, let's lean into this. I don't mind, you know, like the card game seems fun, but we look at the card game and it is like, you know, she's a pretty good reader actually, but it's like pretty hard. Like there's a lot of detail in that game and you can't ignore none of it because it's like the rules of playing the card game Pokemon require you to fully understand what that card does and how it interacts with other people playing with you and stuff. I think she's too young for the card game. I think the physical one.
It's like Magic the Gathering. I've never understood it. It's like you. Yeah, I feel like you would have it locked. Like you're like, oh yeah, 57 mana, pop, pop, poop, pop.
But yeah, like, I'm capable. I want to, but I just, it wasn't right for a daddy daughter deal.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We started watching the show. You know, whatever, 2006 or 96. I don't know. It's old. It's in 4x3. You know, the original deal. And it's pretty good. I think at the time I was like, this is such a, you know, play on capitalism. What, you know, I'm sure it was, but like now I look back, I'm like, it's an endearing little show. I get what they're trying to do. It's fun.
For sure. It's exploiting kids' desire to collect things, you know? And it's actually,
they hammer it. Gotta collect them all. Or they say it like 500 times in the show.
I'm Ash Ketchum. My goal is to collect every Pokemon. You know?
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, that's my mission in life.
I looked up the voice actor where it looks like just some mom.
Yeah,
hilarious. It's funny. Like Homer Simpson was a woman as well. I can't remember that.
Oh, no. Bart. Bart was.
Sorry. Yeah. God dang it. I'm an idiot.
Forget who Homer was. But yeah, not Hank Azaria. Maybe Hank Azaria. But I don't know. We love it in our house. I mean,
I love Brock. Brock closes his eyes when he talks.
We have so much fun
Brock
with it.
Rules. She asks so many times why Brock's eyes are always closed. And I'm like, it's stylistic. I don't know how to explain it to you.
He's cool, Ruby. You got to get it.
Yeah. I like Brock. It was in the early episodes. He's like, I'm a gym trainer and all. And then he's like, but I have brothers and I'm so busy. I can't do it. And then he's like, but I'll come with you for years.
Yeah.
Apparently. Yeah.
What are we doing? Just walking around the island for years? Let's go. Yeah. We're just traveling the country. Yeah.
I love that. That's my favorite part of the premise is just like forest. Oh, now we're in Domino City where stuff is different. You know, walk. Now we're in, you know, some new city. And you're like, oh, this rules. I want that to be my life. So the point of this whole thing is Pokemon Go, dude, still exists. I never played it. I don't know I was at and I missed it. Oh, we downloaded that and now we are in, baby.
You're locked in, huh?
I might be playing it right now on this podcast. I'm not even telling you.
You got a gym at the Pokemon office.
Here's the thing, dude, is that she's playing it and I'm not trying to. Yeah, actually, yes, there is. And there's two Pokestops, which is good. But like, you know, then we like YouTube some stuff. What are the basics of it and stuff? It's pretty complicated, but apparently, like Balatro, you don't have to engage on it on every single level. Like, right. If all she really wants to do is go collect some Pokemons.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't care about gyms. She doesn't care about the special challenges and the special perfumes that you wear to attract the rare Poke. She doesn't give a crap.
She just wants to go, wah, 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 pew.
Boom. Yeah. She's working on her curveball, you know, and all this.
Yeah.
But that game is alive and well, baby.
Isn't it great?
You want to play Pokemon Go? You can go ahead. It's great to me. I feel like I really missed out. Like, where was I? This game rules.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It was, you know, I think it came out a long time ago, but like, because I remember I used it and then
2006.
2006. Yeah. Like, I remember I played it like when it came out. Or something like that. But then I think I got spooked because they were like stealing your Google data or something like that. But if I remember the story correctly.
Wait, am I wrong about this? 2016.
I'm sorry.
I had a six in my mind, which now to me feels like not that long ago. I mean, well, I get that it's
coming up on a decade, so.
But I guess that's a long time. And it had AR. So, like, of course it wasn't 2006. What am I talking about? That was too old ago for that.
It had a resurgence in COVID. And I played it with my kids in COVID. And it was cool.
COVID, okay.
And then, like, because it was like, hey, let's get out of the house. Let's walk around, you know. And then slowly it just turned into, like, Dad, let's go for a walk because I want to play video games. And it got like gross, you know, like because it was all about video games, not about like having fun.
I'm already
struggling
with it. We're only like a week in and I'm like, you suck at walking. I want to go for a walk, but we stop every 4 seconds. You know, it's a little annoying.
Right.
As an adult, you can really rock it. I'm tempted to start my own thing because I can like move my feet and operate the thing and enjoy being outside all at once, I feel like.
Dude, sometimes I'm driving around or like doing a walk, walking the dogs or something, and I'll see somebody just stop like in a weird place, you know, like just in front of somebody's driveway and they're just like squiggling their phone. And I'm like, oh, they're jamming on, they're doing Pokemon Go. Like you can just spot it after a while. It's like a super tell.
We had a special night last night where we came downtown here to do some Pokemoning and there was some smiles on her face because she's little and she's excited and she's running around wearing sparkly pants and catching Pokemon. Yeah. It was great. But it's like downtownist. What's racist for downtown versus
urban,
country? But
urbanist.
It's urbanist. Ruralist, for sure. Because we don't even live in the country, but like where we live, it's just much more of a neighborhood, less dense. And there's jack squat, man. We really got to walk our butts off to find some Pokemon. Dude, you go downtown, it is thriving. There's crap all over the place. You know, this is not fair. Why is it so different?
I'm in a city, but there's a gym a block away, but I have to sit in the right part of my house and the wind has to be just right and I could just snag it. But it's not quite as friendly though. I don't know. But
That's funny.
I think feel like they dial in the radiuses pretty well. Like they're like, you know, if you're rural, there'll be a bigger radius or whatever. But
I'm not sure how it works. But I missed the boat the first time, so I'm enjoying it this time. And there is some depth to that game that I don't know anything about yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really don't even understand the gyms yet. So we're not barely there. You know,
I've done it and I've put some Pokemon in there, but then I have no idea what the point of that was.
Okay.
I don't know, but
good. The stops are easy to understand. You're like, go there, get Pokeballs, because that matters. I even have to do it for her a little bit because she sucks at throwing them. That she'll waste like 10 Pokeballs just on horrible throws, and you're like, you can't. That's not an unlimited resource, you know.
Yeah, for Pokemon you have like 10 of, and you're just like, dude, hey, stop, please, don't.
Yeah, that's. I know,
not can't the be special the colored like, one.
Give me the phone.
Yeah. Not the yellow and black one. No. So that's fun.
Y'all know Andy Bell? I bet a lot of you do. He's a tremendous writer about this whole world of CSS and systems and design and building websites and doing it in the right way. Great guy. He writes over at Piccalilli. That's one of his many websites. Almost more importantly, he's got a studio that he runs called Set Studio, building websites for clients. And you can see the results of his work. They do tremendous work for people. Andy has really poured a whole lot of himself into this new course called Complete CSS. There's a link in our show notes, of course, or just look up Andy Bell's new course, Complete CSS. It's really reasonably priced at £249, and it's even 20% off of that. You can put that coupon code in at checkout. 20% off, the coupon code is ShopTalk. So that's the details of the thing. But this thing is a big deal, you know? It's are you going to learn CSS through this thing? Absolutely. It's all in there, all the syntax and really modern stuff, which matters now because CSS has been changing like crazy. You need this to get all the modern stuff. But CSS, of course, is more than just the syntax and just learning how to do it. It's working well with the people around you, working with designers, simplifying the design concepts, thinking about the design concepts, being able to code what's not there that you just kind of need to know about. You won't be the same developer after this course. It's like learning to be better holistically, core skills, Andy calls them, which is just fantastic. You are going to build a real world website. And when you can just go look at the website you're going to build, it's very legitimately beautiful. It's the kind of course that looks like you get paid to build it, you know, not some lame excuse for a website that's just there to like teach you some syntax or something. It's like, no, that's a nice website. It has the stuff that most websites need on it, and you're going to build it as a system, and you're going to be happy with the results, and you're going to be kind of provably a better developer after it. So like I said, £249, it's got the 20% off with the coupon code ShopTalkShow. There is discounts depending on if you're in a country where the dollar doesn't go as far, that kind of thing. So look into that. I couldn't recommend it anymore. Andy's great. Piccalilli's great. This course is great. Go take Complete CSS. You won't regret it. Yeah, we can kind of cruise past this. We don't have to have you say too much about it, but I had a little blog post about there's this maybe concept that's very maybe town about the, you know, the Justice Department or whoever forcing Google to sell Chrome. They have been formally asked to do it. It is not guaranteed to happen in any way. There's no mandate or anything. And this type of thing has happened before, and companies, you know, jiggled their way out of having to do anything at all. It's very possible that Chrome or Google jiggles around and nothing has to happen with Chrome. Probably some changes will eventually happen or something, but there's no guarantee.
The ruling was you have to sell Chrome, right? That's what the DOJ said?
Or? No, the ruling was you're a monopoly.
Oh, okay.
And then then some people got together and asked them, please, could you please have them sell Chrome?
Okay.
And I don't think there's been a ruling on that particular part yet. So if that happens and they're forced to do it, even that's weird because there's no guarantee there's a buyer. It's not like there's 10 buyers just lining up, chomping at the bit to buy it. Mm-hmm. There may be as few as zero people that want to buy it. And that was my premise, is that it's super expensive, probably. Google's not going to bargain sell it. They're going to put a big-ass price tag on it. And who knows who gets to okay that price or whatever. But it will be high in the billions of dollars, certainly. Then it has no business model. It's not like buying Beats headphones that you buy Beats headphones. The business model is sell more Beats headphones. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like really clear. You don't sell Chrome. It's not for sale. It's free. And you're like, oh, it's free. There must be ads in it or some alternate business model. Guess what? Nope, there isn't. There is no other business model for Chrome. Chrome makes no money. Yeah. None.
Yeah.
Right? It's tangential only.
People to Google is sort of its goal.
Totally. So, it makes people like Google or whatever. I don't even understand it. I'm sure you need to really be inside Google to really understand exactly how Google is a huge benefit to them. And surely it is, because they continue to invest in it for a long time.
I would say, you know, and I'll be fully transparent, I don't know how much I can say about this because I work for a company that does have a web browser. But I would say, for me, I feel like there is reasons they would need a web browser. And if you read that, like Scott, what's his name? I have him here. McLeod comic. way back in the day, they have all their you know, maps, Google Docs, you know, Sheets, all that stuff is web tech, right? And so like,
right.
Like they have a vested interest in improving web tech so that they can make the best software and in owning some web tech space.
Right.
I don't know if like that ever came up in the lawsuit or anything like that. I have no idea. But I just from my perspective, it does seem like they have a reason.
It's Am pretty I like, much all they yeah. do. Yeah. You know? Which is wild. So, of course, you know, and they built the search engine and they built the browser. So making it the default search engine seems super fair. Now, in the lawsuit, what definitely did come up is that they also pay other web browsers to make Google the default search engine. And that's what's monopolistic. So doesn't it stand to reason to say, don't do that. Stop doing that. You can't do that. And then that solves the monopoly problem to some degree. Now, that probably came up as well. I'm just armchair commenting here, but it does seem like that seems like a much less drastic fix to this problem. It also totally destroys Mozilla, so maybe that's not a thing. You know, I don't know. You know? What I'm saying there is that they get a big check from Google every year. And as far as anybody knows, I'm pretty sure that they exist on that very large check that they receive from Google. And if that were to dry up, I don't know that it means absolute demise of their company, but it surely is. They're a lot different of a company without that check. Mm-hmm. Now, I could be 100% wrong about that. So, you know, I'm not citing anything, but you can see the check in their, you know, they're published, you know, because they're, you know, a company such that publishes their financial documents at the end of the year. It's just they're all in there.
Well, and it's on the Safari too, right? It has the same sort of deal.
They pay Apple too. They pay Apple. Apple doesn't need it, but they take it.
Yeah, yeah.
And Apple takes it because it's the best search engine. You know, like I'm sure, right? I don't know. Is it the best? That's up for interpretation. People have their own opinions about that, but by and large, the market likes and
isn't
that,
it
now? Is that sentiment changing a little bit? Yes.
Doesn't it speak to the power of the web that having your search engine in that place where you type URLs, like if it doesn't match a URL, it goes to your search engine, is worth capital B billions. You know what I mean? Like, isn't that very interesting? Like,
so, it's very interesting. So many billions.
So,
yeah.
It just says, I don't know. It says to me like the web's pretty cool. That's what I get out of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It just doesn't feel right in the end to me to be like, oh, the answer to this? Oh, force Google to sell Chrome. Like, what does that fit? I think that's a net negative. That's my point. Yeah.
I guess I don't know enough, but that didn't sit with me as like the right resolution. But I don't know enough. So I'm not, yeah. I felt. Yeah. But you had a good post on it. So I thought it was you're just kind of like, right, like going through like what would be the fallout from this, you know? I mean, it's just kind of
that's complicated. Thank you, you know. And what I was trying to be is like, why would anybody do this? It seems like such a huge liability. The fallout is an interesting thing, though. Like, what about people we know? We know personally all sorts of people who work on Chrome, but not even directly sometimes. Just people that are like, you know, they do documentation and stuff. They work on specs and stuff. They just work on like the web kind of broadly and not directly on like, I write the code that makes a div turn into a rectangle. You know, there's a lot of those people too.
I know those people, yeah.
Those people are for sure gone. Probably, right? Like, what? World where Google is like, I don't own Chrome anymore, but we're going to employ the exact same amount of people to work on just the open source Chromium, even though we have no control over it anymore? It's like, hell no, they won't.
I don't know. Probably not. But like, but that's where I get into the like, they have products that run on the web, and so that they have a reason to be invested in it. You know, I mean. Who was it? Bloomberg made Grid, right? They funded CSS Grid. Like,
yeah.
why is Bloomberg involved, you know? Like, but it's like, well, they wanted to make their little charts and graphs better or something, you know, stock tickers or whatever. And so that worked, you know. Microsoft made that first version of it because they were launching Windows Metro, you know, there, and that was very grid based, you know. So
It's funny how split up it all is. Like, we just got done talking about how just the search engine choice alone is a billions and billions of dollar thing. And that, but still, if you're like, oh, we need MathML to be better, yeah, you're lucky getting $1,500 to,
yes,
to work on it.
Columbia, you know, University gives $85. Well, you know, it's
Thank God for Agalia or whatever.
Yeah, Agalia did it. But I think it was sort of like this, what is the old saying? Like, beg, plead and borrow, you know, like you have to kind of like figure out how you're going to land this feature from a budgetary perspective, you know, and make everybody happy. And
yeah, I had this other thought about there's like certain things, you know, Notion frustrates a lot of people because it's, you know, it got really popular and stuff. And then they never really fixed the, like, it's so slow. It's just such a bummer to use in that way sometimes. But they've done so many smart things over the years. And one of the smartest things they've ever done, as far, if you ask me, is like, get you happy putting your data in it. And the data can be just pages and just stuff, just data, like lowercase d, like your data, you know. And then there's like actually put data in it in the form of databases that are all interlinked and do fancy stuff. That unlocked their API later on and all that stuff. But people use their database without anything, like they just use it. They just use it like a spreadsheet, you know, and they're happy to do so. And now that you've got people doing that, then you can do all this other stuff. The API came along, but now you can have forms and you can just add features to it. But the fact that people like to put their data in it is an amazing trick to get people into doing it. I love stuff like that with businesses. To me, that's like why Cloudflare is so successful, is the first thing they got you to do is change your DNS to point to them.
Yeah.
And that then unlocked all kinds of other crap that they can
do.
You
got a bunch of caching and all this stuff. You got cool stuff from that. Yeah.
DDoS protection. And then you can do, you know, you can like hang URLs off it really easy. They can do your DNS stuff really easily. You can run functions at special places and they can intercept requests and change HTML on the way. It's like it unlocked this treasure trove of crap you could do, but only if first you could convince them to get your DNS going through there. And they did it. They got you to do it. They got a ton of people to do it. You know, I know they're not as big as whatever, any big cloud provider, but they're pretty big. They're pretty successful at doing that. And that's pretty interesting and cool. I thought of it when I read your post about Raycast Focus. What a weird little add-on feature. How strange of a thing. But it's great. And sort of the reason it works well and they can do weird stuff like this is because you already use it for all kinds of other crap. It's the thing that you use to like launch stuff. And people expand that into all kinds of other crap. Have it make me files. I don't know. Have it be the thing that I type AI crap into, or whatever. They're just, because you already use it, they're free to launch little weird, interesting features like this. And it's just so cool. I know that's a kind of a loose connection, but it sounds like you've been liking it.
It's like the gateway, right? Like they got you in, you know, the gateway drug, but they provided enough value that they got you to using stuff. And so now when they add stuff, it's easier to say, oh yeah, I would use that. But this Raycast Focus is kind of just a different level. I mean, it's well executed, but I think it is. It's at the fingertips. I've tried other sort of like focus software, you know, dimming the background, blurring that, you know, like other, you know, Pomodoro timers and all that crap. It doesn't work, you know, or it doesn't work great, you know? And so, but I found if I can just turn this on and block social media, because like when I put my hands on the keyboard, I hit command space. Like my thumbs are, because I have a weird keyboard,
really?
Right? Are on command space. So I can go pa-pa-chow and I'm in Raycast immediately, right? The next command, the next thing my fingers type is, let's see, is probably elk.zone and I go to Mastodon and I check toots.
And then I type beast guy. You type it in manually, go to the website, look at stuff, and then you close the tab.
And I close the tab. And then I say, beast guy. When I'm done with that, when I'm bored with that or I caught up, I go beast guy. And I go to blue sky and I check that out. And then when I'm done with that, I type YouTube and I go to YouTube and I check that out. And it's just this like if I could stop that behavior, that like idle behavior, like, oh, new tab, blue sky, you know, or new tab, YouTube. Like that's like immediately what my brain thinks. Like if I could curb that behavior, like I'm going to be way more productive. And it's working. That's what the weird part is. Like I just turn on focus mode and it gives me a little roadblock on those websites. And then I say, oh yeah, I was actually working. Let me just close that out. You know, and if I want to take a break, I go and I say, pause this, you know, like I'll take a break and I'll watch some horrifying news or whatever it is and then go back in, you know, but you know, stops you from like getting, you know, stuck on the
what
whole.
What does it do? I see in your screenshot, you had to specifically block elk.zone, but there's another one that just says social media. Does it have like what is that block? Is that websites or is it?
I can't find any documentation on it, but it's just, yeah, it would be apps and websites. Like it hooks into your browser, any browser, and then maybe it blocks it at the network level. I'm not sure.
But, and apps as well. So yeah, that's, I guess is part of my point is that it already probably has this kind of root level-y access because of what it needs to do otherwise.
Yeah.
That it's just, to me, it's this genius feature. It's like, no, now that we have that deep access, what else can we do that nobody else can do? You know, you could download a special app for this, but then there's like, oh, it's a special app and I got to give it all this low level access. Do I really trust it? Raycast already has the access. It already has the trust. It's amazing.
No, I mean, I think they have a leg up on like I've used Chrome extensions before. Guess what? I forget the Chrome extension exists and then I delete it. You know, I've used like system level stuff and it's like, yeah, OK, I have to go up into the menu bar and I have to go click OK, focus mode, go. And you know what? Raycast is I already have the command to Raycast, you know, like I'm doing that 100 times a day. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
It's
what else is your what other Raycasts do you? Is it just launcher and this?
I would say you know I have a GIF one for searching GIFs and they'll like search Tenor or Giphy like their API. Yeah. So like you can just like instant grab GIFs, you know, almost like chat apps have that. But I have one called Iconify, which like you can go and get like search for an icon, like whatever menu, you know, and it gives you like 20 different sets of icons, material symbols, solar, tabular, huge. I want our Lucid, which is the what's that one? That's Obsidian's icon set. So like, anyway, there's a lot of cool, nice icons in there, you know? There's also like, I mean, shoot, like, do you know the command to launch VoiceOver? Command shift option F5 or whatever.
I learn it like, once in a while. And then I forget
like you can just like launch VoiceOver, you know, like you can just probably turn it on from here or make a little command for it. But the big one is obviously Almost Maximize, which puts like a little 1-inch border around your whole window and it's Almost Maximize. So.
Yeah, that's a good one. And that you don't install anything for that. That's right in there.
Don't install. I don't have Moom. I don't have rectangles. I don't have all the the native window manager. I know like
I remember being blown away when asking around what people use for that. And they're like, oh, it's just in Raycast. And you're like, geez. Yeah,
it is. So
Yeah. I admit it, I haven't dug into that too much. I have a lot of Moom muscle memory. And lately, you know what I use? Nothing. I just drag my windows around like a schlub.
Cro-Magnon. Yeah.
No. The only time I'm self-conscious about it, because it doesn't feel like it gets in my way that much, is when I'm sharing. And people, sometimes I'll share with like Alex, my co-founder, and his windows are dialed in, baby. One of the things is VS Code. VS Code is probably 2/3 of the window, you know, but he does not rock just one file. I'm like a one filer, pretty much. Once in a while, I'll do two files when I really need to cross-reference across them. But I don't split six ways, you know, in my VS Code. I'm not like looking at six files at once, but he does, you know, he's looking at lots of files at once all the time. I've never seen him look at one file at a time ever.
Yeah. Wow.
So maybe that's a genius move thing. But then, you know, I don't think he uses the VS Code terminal, even though it's fine. But like, I don't know. They feel like hardcore people have their own terminal preferences. I think he's an iTerm guy still. But that's like nestled in there perfectly. So that's what I get sloppy about is like, yeah, sure, my VS Code's open, my browser's open. But then I need the terminal too. And that's like a third thing. And that's when I get sloppy, you know, it's like overlapping some crap and I always have to click over to it and look what's going on. And now it's overlapping something else and whatever. And I don't know. I'm in this sloppy phase right now, where instead of just clicking Command Shift Option 9 or whatever and having everything snap into perfect place. Because then I get distracted. Then I'm like, oh, I got to Google something, but now my browser's too small. So I have to move it. And now I'm out of sync again. And
yeah. You know what? I like Arc got me into using Stage Manager on Mac, which was like this. You only get one app open at a time, but you can actually drag like multiple apps if you're doing code and, you know, something.
No, I don't get it. I do not understand what the hell Stage Manager is. It Stage freaks
Manager,
me out.
It just like puts the other one out of view. Like, so it's just they all line up on the left, the apps, and then like you get one big window. It's kind of cool because it's like,
what is the difference between them? Because I do occasionally use, I used to be a heavy user of the multiple desktops thing in OS X.
Well, it's just for me, it's like I can look, I look at one app at a time and it odd, and I almost maximize that app and then it hides away if it's not that app. And so it's only a problem when I have to use two apps at once. And then it's like, oh no. So,
yeah, it's the trifecta. It's the browser VS Code terminal thing for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of that a little bit, I said VS Code, but I've really been a fickle bastard now that there's so many other ones. So Cursor was the first one that I was
editors
VS Codes essentially because everybody and their brother wants to fork VS Code and do whatever they want in there. Mm-hmm. Which freaks me out a little bit. I know you can't comment on Microsoft stuff, but it's like at some point. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But you had, there's Cursor, right?
Cursor was the first one I was aware of this. And I was like, gosh, what are you doing here? And Cursor, I finally did switch to it for a while. And I was like, all right, this is good. And then the best thing about it to me is that it's just super proactive. You're just sitting there in a file. And it's like, you should do this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're probably right. I should do that. Like, I don't know if it's quite like that, but it's a little more like, it's not always just the autocomplete. It just suggests more. It feels a little smarter and snappier. And it can do a console.log statement correctly, which killed me in Copilot. It would always freaking autocomplete a console.log with like a missing parentheses or something. And I'd be like, dude, this is the easiest thing to autocomplete in the world. Can you please get this right? You know? Anyway, so I liked it and I even coughed up some money for a month of Cursor to try. And I was like, yeah, this is nice, you know, but then all of a sudden there's more, right? Have you seen the other?
Yeah, there's one other one, but then like, ByteDance made one, right? ByteDance
made it. TikTok has a code Tray.
Tray.
TRAE.AI. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh dude, it's free. Cursor is not free. So Tray exists now and you're like, okay, that's interesting. Is it going to be banned in the United States or what? Or like, how do we feel about ByteDance as a company? I don't have any big opinions. I don't know.
If China's spying on my TikToks, what are they doing with root level access to my code base?
Your code
Sorry,
base.
Just
yeah.
kidding.
I should probably be a little more careful about that. But I have a feeling that it sends little bits and bobs to a thing and it gets a response. And like, I don't know. I don't think I'm not working with state secrets in my code here. I'm not that worried about it. Maybe I should be, but whatever. But it's free for now. And they haven't, as far as I know, haven't even hinted about paid plans just yet. Maybe they will or something. It looks very nice. Now, when I open up classic VS Code or whatever, it's just not as polished of a UI. Sorry, it is great. It does lots of intelligent stuff. I do think the design of VS Code is actually pretty good. But then you look at Tray and you're like, oh, I see. Yeah, look at how they round things a little nicer. Look at how the separations between the panels. It's VS Code, It's literally the same. You run all your extensions. It's not that deep of a fork, but the aesthetic improvements are quite nice. And then it's like it does, you know, it just approaches AI slightly differently. It's not that different. VS Code and Copilot, it has a chat thing. It has key commands. It has autocomplete. It has the stuff. It's not that different. But, you know, they approach it a little bit differently. I tried it. It was my least favorite of the group, Trey. But I only tried it for about a day or a day and a half or something. Because at the same time, I heard about another one called Windsurf.
That's from Codium, right?
Codium. And I kind of predisposed to like Codium because they make a browser extension that has autocomplete and it supports CodePen like really nicely. So if you just have Codium installed as a browser extension, you just like get AI stuff in CodePen and it's great. It works great, I think.
Well, and it wasn't there. It's not VS Code, but Zed was the big one. They rewrote everything in Rust.
Well, yeah, and so, I need to try that a little bit more. But that I tried it pretty early on, and I was like, oh, it was like little stuff like GraphQL files aren't even syntax highlighted, and there's no extension to do so. And you're like, well, that's pretty low. It's not like the most important thing in the world for me, but it's a little bit like this is pretty early if you don't even have that, you know. And I didn't like they wanted to be all in on AI, kind of. Not that this is a requirement for me, you know. I don't like, I like messing around with the AI stuff, but you know, I'd use Zed if it felt really super good. But yeah, and then I tried it again recently. I was like, it's just not the same. I think the apps like Cursor and Windsurf and Trey are a little more onto the scene of like what the user experience for AI should be like, whereas Zed I feel like is still a little focused on like what Zed is or something. But it's great. I want Zed to do great. I think there needs to be more than VS Code. I think it's a little wild that like all of these things, including things in the browser like Google's project and Code Sandbox, all this stuff, they're all just VS Code. VS Code, VS Code. Everything's VS Code. The new CodePen notably isn't, and it's not because I don't like VS Code. I use it every day of my life. But I just think there needs to be like a fresh take on the UI. Certainly our project is a fresh take on the UI.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to give Trey best looks. I think Cursor, you know, I hear is super great. I haven't actually used it, but, you know, I don't really do big, broad, sweeping AI changes. So I don't know if I need that. Does that make sense? Like, it's not.
Yeah.
Maybe not for me. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't either, though. I'm not asking it to change five files. I don't even actually, I really don't like it when it touches more than the file that I'm in. I like want only that. But it's to me, it's better. I like it. But the Windsurf one, I'll tell you, it has the most impressive AI. The Codium one.
Codium, and I've heard that from other people. Like, that's a really good code completing AI.
Well, like, I was writing a lot of Go, you know, and I was like, yeah, why don't you help me out? I was writing unit tests as well as, you know, API level stuff and little servers that respond to stuff. I had like a lot of work to do in there. And, you know, once in a while, I'd have some problem. A classic in Go is that you're running something, you got your terminal open and something dies. And it dies for a way that, you know, Go is really good at giving you red squiggles if your code is wrong. And that's easy enough to fix. You know, it helps you out. But AI can help you out, too. But there's a type of problem in Go that it can't be red squiggled because it depends on the data that comes in and such, of a nil pointer dereference. There's pointers in Go. You're constantly using pointers. And that's something that only surfaces in the command line, you know, when that comes up. So when those are in there, and I'm in Windsurf, and I'm like, here, this chunk of code is giving me a nil pointer dereference sometimes. It will really take its time to figure out why. There was one where I swear to God, it was telling me what it was doing. It was dug through our whole code base, looking for stuff, trying to figure out where it's used, how it's used, what could be done, and then had the perfect solution for it. And I was like, oh, dang, that I'm not seeing done on any of these other apps. Windsurf was the willing to go the deepest to figure out what the hell my problem was.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was impressed by that, but it was slow to do so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took a while to get there. And it always feels a little slow to me. So Windsurf's the best AI, but it's slow. Cursor's best overall. Trey looks the best, but has the worst AI. And honestly, you should probably just use VS Code.
Well, and yeah, Zed, I like Zed. I think it just seems experimental, if that makes sense, you know, like just kind of like it. It's I don't know, but it is. It's cool. I don't know. We didn't even get into terminals. I'm using that. The ghosty.
Are you ghosting it up? Me too.
The cool, I'm fast it. One built yeah. on, powered by Zig, of course.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
Which is very important. But I don't know. For me, it's just like fast terminal.
Do you have any setting at all? Like, do you, when you go into settings, do you have a single thing in there?
No. Nope. I want it to have more padding because everything's kissing the edge there. And yeah, I don't know how to do that. Kissy.
Yeah. There is one. There's one for padding. Okay. Let's find it.
live coding. But apparently, isn't the.
We don't have to do it right now. I just mean, let's make it our thing. Because I did see somebody posted what their settings were, and I was like, oh, I kind of like it. But I think I'm attracted to the idea right now of having zero settings. It looks nice, and I did nothing. It is just off the shelf, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it, to me, it's crucial that it supports Tmux, which not all these fancy things do, but. I have a serious love hate with it, but yeah, go.
What's neat about Ghosty is you can actually Command D and start like opening, like you can like in Command Shift D splits it horizontally. So like you can like kind of like start getting a Tmux-y vibe, but you don't have the, what is it? The context, you don't have the shared context, but yeah. Oh man, I thought I'd be winning this. I don't have this. anyway, I think I do have a theme. Do I have a theme? I have a theme. Oh, well, I'm bad at command line. Mm-hmm. I don't do this.
I liked the colors, the default, but yeah. Yeah, good, you know, good job. I listened to like one podcast on it. And he's like, I don't know, I just made a terminal or whatever. Cause he's, I think the guy's like ultra rich, isn't he?
He's from HashiCorp, the guy who's like basically made and sold HashiCorp. So like Terraform, so, all that
yes,
stuff.
Yes, ultra
so,
rich. Though.
Yeah, like I just think like, the ethos is cool. He's like, I want a good fast terminal, and that's what I'm, and it has to look good and feel good and stuff. And so I think that's like, fits my priorities, but.
Well, kind of, but then like, is iTerm not that?
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I think iTerm's a little kludgy. I don't know. I'm going to be, compared to Ghosty, I think it's a little weird.
I also don't like how, like, you know, they do pretty good. It's like a pretty good terminal. And then there hasn't been a lot going on with it. And then, of course, it's one of those companies that's just like, yeah, we're going to slap some AI nuggets on there, baby. Don't you want that?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I don't know. We were talking about code editors. Sorry, this is going long, isn't it? I've been actually, my coworker Zaki Ma uses Helix, I think, which is like a Vim replacement, or Emacs maybe is more accurate. But
interesting, really.
Yeah, so I'm actually like, you know, as cool as these new VS Codes are, I'm actually kind of swinging this way. Like I'm kind of like, maybe I just bite the bullet and learn how to do this, you know? The criticism I've heard is like, you know, it doesn't quite have Vim bindings. It doesn't quite have Emacs bindings. It's kind of mixed up its own
you're learning
bindings.
Something super proprietary.
Right. So that's where it's just sort of like, ooh, I don't know if I want to do that. But, you know, but again, I'm not I don't wizard around, dude. I point and click where I want to do something else. I hate to ruin everyone's picture of me, the ultra elite coder, but man, I oftentimes just point and click at things and make it happen. So
for sure. So. That's hence my love hate with Tmux. If you've ever used it, man, you can't just go clicking around in Tmux because it'll like, as you select stuff, it assumes that you just immediately want to copy it onto your clipboard and selecting sucks. And then it immediately scrolls to the bottom after you're done selecting. It's like, I don't know what's going on here, but this is, somebody is like a UX sadist who made this thing. And yet it's like the only real plausible option for like, I got about 15 commands that all need to be running together. What do you use then? And it's like, well, it's this. So
more accurately, I think it's was created by people who really needed to run 10 different COBOL applications. So it's optimized for how they saw the world. And maybe
it does have that, like, whatever, 70s feel to it or something.
Yeah. So, all right, we should wrap it up. That's plenty of talking about video games, code editors, and terminals. We did it all. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast or choice. Be sure to start our favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Shard it up, please. And join us on the Discord, patreon.com/shoptalkshow. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.